This is number 0064, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0064. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, meet Danielle Ward from the town of Trundle, Australia. That's a small community that is offering homes for rent for $1 a month. They just want to populate the town. So what kind of people are they looking for?
We're obviously looking for people probably with children, school-age children, to get some more numbers in our school. We've got two wonderful schools here in Trundle. And, yeah, we're just trying to get a few more families into town and raise the numbers of the school so we could get more teachers and things like that, and just to keep the community going.
Mark Price is the director of the British horror film Colin. This zombie movie was shot on a really tiny budget, and it was also shot very quickly.
Yeah, we tend to shoot quite quickly. I mean, when you're shooting in the streets and you've got traffic and people with their arms hanging off, you kind of want to get the shots quickly before the police show up to say to start asking questions. We didn't have any permits either.
Stuart Nellman is along with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nellman. Now, in this edition of Book Banter, I'll review Amy Asbeck's memoir of her late husband, actor John Ritter, called With Love and Laughter, John Ritter, and other books related to Three's Company. Yes, there are such things. So come and knock on our door. We'll be waiting for you on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0064, was Richard Deschamps, news anchor from CJAD News in Montreal. Thank you very much, Richard, for being the guest Slater on this edition of The Stuff File. And very quickly, I want to mention that you can get your very own Stuff File gear. Yes, you can check out the Stuff File store. There you'll find Stuff File t-shirts, caps, mugs, water bottles, tote bags, and even teddy bears. Yes, teddy bears. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and you can order your favorite item. And hint, hint, they would all make great stocking stuffers just in time for the holidays. I'm just saying. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And we start off with a very interesting story that deals with British intelligence. Keith Jeffrey's book on the British Intelligence Service, the book entitled The Secret History of MI-16, was published in September and serialized in the Times of London. Now, it revealed that the first chief of the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, during World War I, recommended as a best use or best source of invisible ink, semen. Yes, apparently the best invisible ink had semen in it. It would not react to ink detecting, that would be iodine vapor, and was, of course, and I quote, readily available. Yes, I guess it would be. By the way, the man who came up with this idea, and I kid you not, his name was Mansfield Cumming. Couldn't make that up if I tried. And it's ink that is readily available. Moving right along, we go to Hagerstown, Maryland. A Maryland jury has convicted a woman of burglary, assault, and reckless endangerment for breaking into her neighbor's house wearing nothing but a bridal skirt and a veil on a snowy night in February. Okay, do you have that image burned in your head? A bridal skirt and a veil wearing nothing else, and it's winter. 33-year-old Melissa Wagaman testified that a combination of cold medicine and marijuana apparently made her hallucinate that she was getting married and her mother was locked in her neighbor's basement. Wagaman broke a dining room window with her head, causing shattered glass to cut an artery in her neighbor's arm. The jury rejected defense arguments that Wagaman truly believed she needed to enter the house and didn't know she was endangering her neighbor. She faces up to 23 years in prison. Gee, I guess that wedding's off, huh? Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about Halloween, shall we? It wasn't all fun and candy Halloween night for folks in the Fox Chapel neighborhood of Ocean City, Maryland. Police had to be called in to arrest a 47-year-old drunk Florida man who was not only a long way from home, but was going door-to-door trick-or-treating wearing only a diaper and shouting profanities. Police arrested Joseph David Devana of Sarasota, Florida at around 9:15 p.m. Halloween night. He allegedly cursed at both adults and kids trying to get them to give him candy. Some people just never outgrow Halloween, do they? And we'll take one final look at Halloween 2010. It seems the Halloween Crime of the Year torch has been passed to Lincoln, Nebraska. That's where 19-year-old Matthew Nevine was pulled over late Halloween night for drunk driving. He had come from a Halloween party and was still in his Halloween costume. He was dressed as, wait for it, a breathalyzer machine. Can't make this stuff up, I tell you. Now, here's a woman that I actually kind of partially agree with. To a point, anyway. A lawyer in Xi'an, China, filed a lawsuit in September against a movie house and film distributor for wasting her time because she was exposed to 20 minutes of advertisements that began at the posted time for the actual movie to begin. She is requesting a refund, the equivalent of about $5.20, plus damages of an equal amount, plus the equivalent of about 15 cents for emotional damages, plus an apology. Hey, I'd be just simply happy with the apology. But there you go. Okay, anyone who's tried to do an Australian accent has undoubtedly uttered the words, g'day, mate. And thanks to movies like Crocodile Dundee and the Outback Steakhouse commercials, we've all come to accept the word mate as a typical friendly greeting for our friends down under. Unless, of course, you're in court. Then the word can land you in jail. Thomas John Collins was sent to prison after twice calling Magistrate Matthew McLaughlin mate during a hearing last week. When Magistrate McLaughlin objected and ordered Collins to address him as Sir or Your Honor, the defendant replied, okay, mate. That's when McLaughlin lost his patience and sent Collins to jail. Collins later returned to the courtroom to apologize, but none of this sits well with Ipswich City Councillor Paul Tully, who said there was nothing more Australian than calling someone mate, and it's hard to believe someone could be locked up for using the word. He issued a statement saying, I say to every magistrate, come on, mate, get off your high horse and show some tolerance. He also called on Australia's Chief Magistrate, Judge Brandon Butler, to introduce annual anger management classes to all Queensland magistrates. There you go. Okay, so let's get to our first guest on the program. And speaking of Down Under, we go all the way to Australia. An Australian rural community, desperate to encourage new families to move in and revitalize the town, is offering to rent farmhouses to interested families for $1 a week. The hamlet of Trundle, 215 miles northwest of Sydney, has a population of 380. One of the 380 is Danielle Ward from the Trundle Hotel, and she joins us on the line right now. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, this is a little interesting concept that you've got going on. First of all, who is eligible to apply for this?
Anyone is eligible. So, anyone at all. We're obviously looking for people, probably with children, school-age children, to get some more numbers in our school. We've got two wonderful schools here in Trundle. And, yeah, we're just trying to get a few more families into town and raise the numbers of the school so we could get more teachers and things like that, and just to keep the community going.
So this is not open to just people who are, for instance, in Australia. You're opening this up to anybody who can...
Anybody at all. The more the merrier.
Okay. Now, aren't you worried in these days of the economy the way it is worldwide that you might have literally a stampede at your door?
Well, I don't know about that. It'd be lovely. Before we started this, we were saying, you know, it'd be great if we got a couple of applicants. And I think at the moment, some of the girls that are on the committee were just down checking a few emails, and there's over 200 applications so far. And the media release went out on Monday. And, yeah, 200 applications already, and many more inquiries as well.
Now, how far afield are those applications coming from?
Look, we had one from Istanbul yesterday. So, one from Turkey. We've had We've had some Indian press at the moment. Canadian, obviously. I had an email from a guy in Holland the other day. So just, yeah, from every corner of the globe, really.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, the population stands at about 380. What was the maximum population? Has this been a declining population? And what was it at one point?
It certainly has been. So I think when I own a pub here, which is 101 years old, which is quite old for Australia, or quite a new country, I guess. But at one stage, they say there was around, you know, 5,000 people here. And, you know, 101 years ago. So it's been ever declining since then, I think.
Now, I understand some of the issues. There's a bit of a concern about drought. Is that correct?
Yeah, there certainly has been. Sorry, I've just had someone walk into the pub and ask me a question. There's been, for the last probably 7 or 8 years, there's been, yeah, just an awful drought here. It's been terrible. This season at the moment is absolutely glorious, though. The crops are, you know, up to your hip. It's amazing, and we're not far off harvest at the moment, so if we get a bit of fine weather, you know, the crops will all be off, and it's a really busy period at the time at Trundle, so it's just some rain and some lovely green pasture has just been really uplifting for the whole community.
So, as I said in the introduction, you're offering homes, basically, for rent, farm homes,
yep,
for $1 a week. So, $52 a year.
That's exactly right.
What exactly does that get you?
I mean, obviously, it's not just, you know, there is a dollar a week. So, the houses are in need of a lot of love, I guess. They're gorgeous old country homes. But no one's lived in some of them for over 20 years. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done with a bit of paint and, you know, a good clean-up and a bit of a garden. So, I mean, that's kind of part and parcel of your dollar a week, is to, you know, try and get the homes livable.
So basically you're looking for somebody who's A, adventurous, B, probably a little bit handy, and C, someone who's obviously willing to live in a rural community with their families, correct?
Yep, that's exactly right, Peter. Yeah, that's exactly right. Definitely someone who's handy will definitely help. People who are ready for a change and, a bit adventurous and ready to take on a new challenge and get involved in a lovely little community.
Is there a minimum or maximum time that they can live in this dwelling at that price, or is this an ongoing, open-ended affair?
So at the moment, we're sort of playing it a little bit by ear at the moment. It's we're all a little bit green and we're not entirely sure what we're doing. I mean, we've got a fair idea, but at the moment the it'll be like a normal rental agreement with the farmer, and it's a 3-year lease at this stage.
The reason why I asked earlier as to whether anybody can be involved in this is I know in a lot of cases there are some strict regulations when it comes to immigrating into Australia. Do you have to take all those things into considerations, or have you worked out those details?
Well, that's something that we actually talked about in a bit of a meeting yesterday. And I'm not too sure about what the rules are with Canada, but I know with the UK that there's an arrangement that if you spend 4 months working on a rural farm, then you can extend your visa by 18 months. I'm not entirely sure of the details, but it's something along those lines. So perhaps Canada has the same kind of agreement.
So right now I understand you have, what, 5 houses that this is available for?
Yeah, so 5 houses at the moment. There's plenty more about. There's obviously, some people who are a little bit dubious about the whole idea. But 5 houses at the moment with potentially many more.
So, again, you've had a lot of emails, about 130, you said?
Over 200 applications.
Over 200
actual applications and many more emails.
So if you've had 200 applications, let's look at a perfect scenario. You've got 5 houses now. There are about another 20 or so dotted around the countryside. So let's say you fill up those 20 houses. Would there be opportunities for people to for you to offer up more houses in the future? Could you really populate this community doing this?
I don't see any reason why you couldn't, and I don't see any reason why it couldn't extend on to other little towns around here. There's a town to the south of us, 23 kilometres, that could do it. There's a town to the north of us by about 35 kilometres that this could definitely happen in as well.
Okay, so I mentioned in the introduction that it's a hamlet 215 miles northwest of Sydney. So give us a little idea.
But it's actually, that's not quite right. Actually, okay. It's about 550 kilometres west of Sydney.
Okay.
Smack bang in the centre of New South Wales.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about what it's like, what the climate's like, that kind of thing.
It's hot in summer, really hot. It's pretty cold in winter. It doesn't snow, but it does get pretty cold. It's just a lovely, vibrant little town, full of really lovely people, very welcoming, and it's just got a lot of potential. There's lots of things that go on. There's lots of community involvement, but we just need, we need some more people to help out with organising the functions that we have, and we just need more community involvement.
And I'm calling to you from Canada, so I know a little bit about extreme weathers living here.
Yeah.
What do you consider hot? What do you consider cold?
Okay, so it gets up to, it might get to fairly extreme hot would be 48 degrees. I don't know what that would be in
48 degrees
Fahrenheit.
Yeah, 48 degrees Celsius. That is very hot, yes.
Yeah, it's stinking hot here. And, okay. It gets to the minuses at night time, maybe minus 5 at night time, and we get some frosts and things. Right. During the day, though, it's not too bad. I guess we've got... I think it's pretty cold. I lived in the UK for a while. It's not quite that cold, but it is fairly chilly.
Well, I, you're talking to a Canadian. Minus 5 Celsius is not cold. Trust me.
Yeah, fair enough.
That 48, though, seems pretty darn hot. I got to give you that.
They'll definitely know about it if they're here in summer.
Now, had your little hamlet thought about, getting people coming from other parts of Australia? I mean, you have a big country. There's a pretty fair-sized population. Had you thought about doing that before going
definitely.
Far afield?
And the press release has gone around to all of Australia. So, we've done some radio interviews that are going to Perth and Adelaide, so Western Australia, South Australia, Northern Territory, Queensland. We've had some applications from Tasmania. It's all around the country is where applications are coming from. I had a guy show up at the pub here the other night that had driven from Melbourne, so... which is 9 hours away from here. Mm. So it's definitely, the town is a buzz at the moment.
Well, it certainly is a unique idea, and I wish you well in going ahead with your plans. People who want to find out more information about this can go to your website. What's the website?
That's right, which is trundletreechange.com.au.
Okay, that's www.trundletreechange.com.au.
That's exactly right.
And again, what are the qualifications you're asking for? What are you looking for when people fill out the applications?
Ideally, we want families with children, people who are reasonably handy, that are ready for a change and open-minded and just ready to start a new life in our lovely town.
Well, we wish you luck. I thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Peter.
Danielle Ward from the Trundle Hotel in Australia. If you want more information or if you would like to fill out an application, you can go to their website at trundletreechange.com.au. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0064, and you'll find their links.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the director of the horror flick, Cullen, plus Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Bander. And of course, there is an idiot of the day, but right here, right now, more stuff. And yes, collection agencies are evil. Now, I know you should pay your bills, and yes, it probably sucks working for a collection agency that has to hound people who don't pay their bills, but this is ridiculous. In Erie, Pennsylvania, the sign out front told people they were entering the UniCredit Debt Resolution Center, but once they got inside, debtors were fooled into believing they were in an actual courtroom with a judge. But the whole thing was fake, and now a lawsuit has been filed against the company by the Pennsylvania Attorney General himself. UniCredit America is accused of deceiving, misleading, and coercing hundreds of consumers into paying off their debts by building a mock courtroom complete with a judge's bench and witness stand. Allegedly, UniCredit lured debtors to the building by sending employees who appeared to be sheriff's deputies to their homes, implying that they would be taken into custody if they failed to appear at the phony court hearings. Erie County Sheriff Robert Mursky said, "It really galls me that someone would stoop this low." The Attorney General's office is asking a judge to freeze the company's assets and order it to cease operations. Now, collection agencies might be evil, but if you've listened to this program time and time again or read my blog, you know I also believe cats are evil. Little pieces of evil, plotting against mankind. And I search high and low for stories to prove this point. And they're out there. You don't have to look too hard. Here's the latest. In my ongoing quest to prove that cats are evil, a stowaway cat on a New Zealand train injured the driver so badly that a replacement driver had to be called in, disrupting rail service in the capital of Wellington. Kiwi Rail said the driver discovered the cat after pulling into Wellington Station late last week and was scratched so badly when he tried to capture the animal that he needed medical attention. A replacement driver had to be summoned as emergency cover for the injured driver. Said a spokesperson, "It's very unusual. When I spoke to the train manager after his hand had been damaged and it was finally bandaged up, he said that he had been working in trains for 4 decades and it was the first time he had been attacked by a cat." He said the cat had been caught and that Kiwi Rail was appealing to its owner to contact the SPCA Animal Welfare Organization to reclaim it. The spokesperson went on to say, "We can assure that we won't be charging the owner a fare." Well, why not? At least charge the cat. Don't let him get away with this scot-free. Anyway, they're evil. That's all I'm saying. Moving right along, students at Memphis City Schools don't feel they are getting a complete educational experience, mainly because there's no ketchup. No mustard either. Calvin Jones, the interim head of food services, said the schools have plenty of bulk containers of the condiments, but not enough cafeteria workers to squirt them into little plastic cups. Isn't there an unemployment problem in the United States? They can't find someone to squirt the condiments into these little plastic cups? Anyway, fortunately, the school board has approved $77,514 to buy those little fast food packages of ketchup and mustard, which they hope to have in lunch lines by next week. But for now, the French fries, corn dogs, and chicken tenders will have to go unadorned unless students opt for hot sauce, barbecue sauce, or mayonnaise. That's just sacrilegious, isn't it? Anyway, speaking of condiments, it's been over a year, but police in Boise, Idaho, think they have finally solved the case of the condiment caper. Turns out 74-year-old Joy L. Cassidy is the primary suspect in a string of crimes where someone has been unloading bottles of condiments into library book return boxes. The ill-named Joy was picked up at the library moments after police say she pulled through the outside drive-thru and dumped a jar of mayo into the book return box. There have been at least 10 such incidents. Library employees have reported finding books in the drop box also covered in corn syrup and ketchup. Seriously, Grandma, what is your problem? Maybe we shouldn't fine her. Maybe we shouldn't put her in jail. Maybe we should force her to go to Memphis and put the condiment into those little plastic cups for the kids at school. It's a win-win situation for everybody that way, don't you think? Okay, and finally in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest, Sarah Glidden is a sophomore cross-country athlete for Hortonville High School in Warsaw, Wisconsin, and she's a darn good runner. Unfortunately, she won't be competing in this year's cross-country finals after a bit of bad luck at the Division I cross-country sectional qualifying race. She had only about 100 meters to go in the 4,000-meter race, and was well on her way to qualifying when a deer ran out of the woods and straight into her. Sarah was stunned and thrown off her stride, but she was spun around and managed not to fall down. And while she finished the race, she came in a disappointing 18th and thus didn't qualify for the WIAA state meet. But the upside is now she's getting offers to join hunting parties for Wisconsin's upcoming deer season. Sarah says, "Hunters want me to go with them because they say I'm a magnet for deer." While she's still kidded by friends and fellow students, she's handled it all with grace and a sense of humor. Good for her. What was the saying? Nothing runs like a deer? Or apparently now, Sarah? Yeah. Good thing she didn't run into a zombie. Oh, there's a segue into our next guest. Mark Price is the director of the British horror film Colin, which breathes new life into the undead. It's about the life of a zombie told through his own eyes. It's now available on DVD, and Mark joins us via Skype to Skype communications from London, England. Hello, Mark.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you have brought this zombie literally to life on the screen, but you've done it rather inexpensively, I may add.
It was. I think we're just like low-budget filmmakers, really, and like every other low-budget filmmaker I know, we just had to use what we had available to us to try and tell our story. So.
But just how low was your budget?
The idea was that I think there's a lot that's being touted about. I think at the moment this is 70, through inflation, I guess, is $75 or $70, I think is $70.
Okay. A lot of people might think that $75, that's no budget.
Yeah. It pretty much is. Yeah, that was the idea, actually. The plan was to not spend any money at all. So we're already 100% over budget.
Here in Canada, because I know I drive a minivan. Here in Canada, that's more than a tank of gas.
Oh, wow!
Sorry, that's less than a tank of gas, is what I'm saying.
The thing is that the money that we spent, we spent on things we didn't really need to spend it to either. Spend it on. So it's like I ended up buying a pack of tapes for a shoot that I turned up the shoot. I only had one tape with me. I didn't have any more, so we had to go and buy some. But by the time the guy came back with the tapes, we'd actually wrapped, and we didn't need them anyway. So it was a total waste of money. I'm really, really bad with my spending, I think. Something that should be celebrated. So.
Judging by what you've just said, not only is it an inexpensive budget, but it sounds like it's a short shooting schedule.
Yeah, we tend to shoot quite quickly. I mean, when you're shooting in the streets and you've got traffic and people with their arms hanging off, you kind of want to get the shots quickly before the police show up. To start asking questions. We didn't have any permits either.
I was just about to say this is like guerrilla filmmaking, which I'm sure is part of the lure of all this. You've never asked for permits and the like?
No. I mean, no. I think we did shoot a street fight sort of sequence for the movie that was quite big, and lots of explosions, smoke, screaming, body parts strewn across the street. And we told all the people who lived there. But I guess someone wasn't paying attention because they did call the police. And then one policeman showed up by himself, responding to reports of a riot. And I think he was kind of relieved, really, that it wasn't a riot. It was just us shooting a movie, and he didn't take any of our equipment off us. He just smiled, took some pictures, and went home quite content. So, phew, he's a bit lucky.
Now, your full name is Mark Vincent Price. With the name Vincent Price, were you predestined to make horror films?
I don't know. You know, it's quite odd because my dad's middle name is Vincent as well. My dad's name is Colin. I named the movie after my dad, so his full name is Colin Vincent Price. I think my grandparents were fans of Vincent Price. My dad isn't a fan of horror, so I don't know. It's kind of a strange one. But he liked Colin, and that's the important thing, I think. It's quite a relief that he actually liked the movie I named after him.
So tell us about the film. As I said in the introduction, it's the life of a zombie told through his own eyes. Are you somebody who's shall we say, sympathetic to the zombie cause, as it were.
Well, you know, I just kind of thought, oh, I'm worried I'm going to sound pretentious now, but I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go for it. I hope I don't sound too pretentious. But I kind of think that we live in really interesting times where I think the question of the other side is always being asked, whatever the conflict. And I kind of thought it would be really interesting just to tell a zombie movie and not necessarily slap the label evil on something, but let's just sort of explore that side of I guess, of a zombie, really. And I just thought that'd be quite interesting. I thought an audience would be quite open to that. And by an audience, I kind of figured my friends, who I thought would be the only audience for the movie in my bedroom. So that was just my approach, really. And I wanted to do something that's a bit different for the genre. And I the idea was that it would go off to, I guess, horror websites, and it would be maybe a little teeny thread in a forum somewhere. And I just like the idea of eventually someday someone who I didn't know managing to get hold of the film and watching it and hopefully liking it and, you know, contributing to a to a forum post somewhere. So that was all I ever really expected.
Well, you mentioned your original plan. Was it your goal to, because the film is now available on DVD, was it your goal to be a mainstream film, a DVD film? I mean, you shot this film in a guerrilla style. Did you expect it was going to remain an underground film and only a few people would see it? The fact that it's going to be on DVD and the masses could get it, was that part of your original plan?
No, not at all. I mean, I'd hope we'd get some sort of distribution and maybe something quite small. But I certainly didn't expect, I mean, what's happened to have happened. And it's just been, I kind of don't understand why us, to be perfectly honest with you. Because like I said, every other filmmaker I've met, they make their movies in the exact same way. They just make use of whatever it is they've got available to them. I don't quite understand why we're the ones that get all the attention for it, because every filmmaker I know is doing the same thing.
Do you think that your style of filmmaking is almost bringing films back to the masses? I mean, we've reached a point where a lot of the big movies out there seem to have really bloated budgets, and we're not necessarily getting our bang for their buck.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of focus now on sequences and set pieces rather than story and or at least an emotional connection to the characters involved. I think horror is a really good example of that now, where it seems to be as many kills as you can squeeze into 90 minutes with no real, with no connection to the characters whatsoever. And that was always the thing. I mean, the reason that the gory moments in those 80s horror movies had so much impact is that you kind of liked the character that was going through that. And I think that's gone now. I mean, I'm not like knocking the Saw movies or anything. I mean, I think they're pretty good fun, but there's no tension in those movies at all. You're just waiting for the next bit where someone gets killed in an incredibly inventive way. But in all fairness, they managed to keep quite inventive for, was it like 7-8 movies now?
Your movie was at the Cannes Film Festival?
It was, yes. It was in the film market. Not the actual festival itself. It's part of the film market. So it was there with 8,000 other movies.
What was it like just to hear the fact that your film was part of that festival?
That was amazing. I mean, I it was Helen Grace, really, the sales agent. It was her idea to go to Cannes, and I was living out my overdraft at the time. I really felt, a holiday wasn't the smartest move financially for me. And I didn't think it would be, I didn't think we'd stand out with, like I said, 8,000 other movies. So, but we went, and it was just a little news story to a British network, ITN. That went out to the Press Association after that. And before we knew it, I was answering all these questions. I guess because it was a quiet year at Cannes and because the global economic crisis was was making headlines all over the world. So I think we sort of fit into that quite comfortably, and we were able to sort of take advantage of it to try and let everyone know about our movie.
Now, being a filmmaker, is that your full-time job, or as the saying goes, is there a day job involved here somewhere?
There is a day job. Yeah, I'm not sure I'd actually call myself a filmmaker quite yet. I think maybe when it becomes the thing I do to pay the rent, then I'll be like, yeah, I think I'm a filmmaker now. There is a day job that I've got, and I've been quite lucky with it. Actually, they're very patient with me there, and actually that was where I wrote the script for Colin, where I edited most of it as well.
What do you do?
I just answer phones. It's me and another guy, and we coordinate sort of a car company for the car division of a courier company. And initially it was very quiet. We're a lot busier these days.
So is making films, is this the passion that drives you through the course of the day and allows you to do the other things, the more mundane things that you might do in a day-to-day existence?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a total fan of film, and that's all encompassing. I mean, I kind of feel like guilt for having not seen as many films as I should have, but I will watch anything. And then that's from like your biggest blockbuster to your smallest sort of film that someone made who lives in the same area who just gave it to me, you know, on DVD one time because we were chatting in a pub. You know, I mean, I kind of love that. One of the best things about Colin is that filmmakers sort of get in touch through Facebook and they say, I've made a movie, would you mind having a look at it? And I'm like, I'd love to. Because there's nothing, it's like a real treat to be able to watch a film that isn't distributed and then you find some amazing gems some really talented people have made. And I guess that, you know, we just got really lucky, I think, with ours. Because distribution, that's a difficult beast to control.
It's quite the global village, isn't it?
And it's really kind of, I mean, I do find that distributors can be quite cowardly, I suppose, in their approach. I mean, I was talking to my sales agent. She was saying that, particularly with horror movies, they don't often watch them. They'll just go through them fast forward and they'll work out the average kills. And if there's enough of them, they've got some in the market, so they feel. So they'll take the film. It's such a cold way to look at something that people have like worked really hard on. Regardless of whether the film's any good or not, a lot of people's, you know, sweat have gone into making these movies, and it's a shame when people don't have the courtesy to at least watch it.
So the film is called Colin, and how can people get their hands on it? As I said, it's available on DVD.
Yes, it's. I mean, I know you can get it on Amazon, and I always feel bad plugging it, but there's a 2-disc set available, and on it is a lovely little making of. That is just, even if you hate the film, the making of is so much fun. So, you know, at least you can kind of get something out of it before you try getting your money back.
Okay. And is there a website for the film?
There is, yeah. It's colinmovie.com. And that's, yeah, I think you've got like a lot of information on any cinema screenings that we've got as well that are coming up that I think are happening right now.
Excellent. Well, good luck to you with the film. And we look forward to not only this film, but future projects indeed.
Thank you very much.
Mark Price, the director of Colin. You can check out their website at colinmovie.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this program, and this show is number 0064. And you'll find links to the movie's website and also links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order the film directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones. Today, I would like to share a quote from a man who provided the best advice on lawsuits I've ever heard. Coincidentally, this man had the best name for someone involved in law that I've ever heard, too. His name was Learned Hand. Yes, really. And he graduated from Harvard Law School more than 100 years ago. True to his name, he became one of the most learned and respected judges in the history of the United States. The opinions he wrote are still cited by lawyers. After presiding over hundreds of lawsuits, this is what he had to say on the subject, and I quote, "Litigation is to be dreaded beyond almost anything, short of sickness or death." End of quote. Let's be fair. Sometimes the only way to resolve a dispute is to file a lawsuit. But what Judge Hand knew is that lawsuits should be used only as an absolute last resort. Because of the time and money it cost everyone involved, the judge's advice is as good today as it was all those years ago. Find out more. Go to our website at foundationforfairciviljustice.org.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter, I just want to say, come on, knock on our door. We'll be waiting for you, where the kisses are hers and hers and his, three's company too.
Oh, we love it when you open up with a song.
Yeah, well, it's not to tribute to the jiggle shows of the late 70s, early 80s. Actually, it's about one of the stars, the late John Ritter.
Right.
Who, passed away 7 years ago, actually. And his widow, Amy Asbeck, who's an actress in her own right, wrote a book about it. So, you know, when the late John Ritter signed an autograph, he always preceded his signature with the inscription, "With love and laughter, John Ritter." Which is why when he suddenly died of an undiagnosed aortic dissection on September 11th, 2003, many of his fans and friends reacted with a great deal of shock. Because here was a much-loved actor and comedian who found new life with his second wife, Amy Asbeck, who you remember from her on Wings, his five-year-old daughter, Stella, and as the star of the ABC sitcom Eight Simple Rules, which was starting production of its second season at the time of his death. However, now, exactly 7 years after his untimely death, Asbeck has tried to come to terms with this tragic loss by penning a memoir of her life with John Ritter called With Love and Laughter, John Ritter. Now, the main argument is that in this book was that John Ritter was a living embodiment of the bumbling, hyperactive character Jack Tripper, which he played to Emmy Award-winning perfection on Three's Company for 8 years. He not only loved to make people laugh on camera, but also whenever the opportunity presented itself when the camera stopped rolling as well. He always was accommodating to his fans and was generous for giving his time to charitable causes that he championed, especially towards research to combat cerebral palsy, which affected his brother Tommy. Now, she demonstrates in the book how Ritter possessed such a genuine yet goofy joie de vivre that was infectious no matter where he went or whom he encountered, whether it be making a stint on Broadway in Neil Simon's play The Dinner Party as a family experience, or going just plain bananas with his idol Jerry Lewis at Sardi's Restaurant in New York City following a performance in Lewis's blockbuster revival of Damn Yankees back in 1995. But the book works very well as a fond, affectionate remembrance of a genuine, talented, likable individual. But however, it falls flat in two respects. First, when Asbeck tries too hard to inject some of her sense of humor throughout the text, and it's quite painfully obvious when you come across these attempts. And second, in the last quarter of the book, when she tries to rationalize her grief at Ritter's untimely passing, if she would have expressed her grief in these pages in a more honest way, instead of trying to be a philosopher or a psychologist, it would have made for a better way to end the book. However, to her credit, Asbeck creates a great deal of awareness to the mostly undetected silent killer that is aortic dissections and gives some very useful and important warning signs and actions to take if you suspect you may have symptoms that could lead to aortic dissections. But with Love and Laughter, John Ritter as a whole is not a bad book about what life was like with one of television's funniest and much-loved performers, who was someone who certainly left us too soon.
Now, as you said, he was a very funny and likable individual, which is one of the things we all miss about John Ritter. He brought joy and humor to everything he did and was very funny and made the material funnier than it was originally written. I know you just mentioned the fact that you're not necessarily crazy about Amy's attempt at humor in the book, but one of the things we also lost when John died was Amy on the small screen and the big screen in a similar way, because I find she too has that similar situation in which she usually, and you say not necessarily in this book, but usually brings stuff to the funny point, to the funny boiling point, better than what was originally written.
Oh, exactly. And also, if you like to read about Three's Company, and there are a couple of books that I could recommend very quickly. One is Chris Mann's book, Come and Knock on Our Door, which was published in 1998. It was an excellent, thorough history of what went on behind the scenes at Three's Company and interviewed practically every member of the cast. Even got to get the behind-the-scenes story of Suzanne Summers' differences with the cast members as she was getting more fame, and also what happened with her firing. And also, speaking of Suzanne Summers, her 1988 best-selling memoir called Keeping Secrets, which is how she dealt with a family that was basically, most of her family was alcoholics, except her and her mom. And it's a very gripping, powerful story. And although she's written health books and exercise books and diet books right now, Keeping Secrets is quite a memoir, and it's not one of your usual celebrity tell-alls. It's really a powerful story.
And getting back to John Ritter for a moment, he was always concerned while he was alive about the fact that his father died suddenly at a very young age.
Yeah, well, also they said, well, Tex Ritter, he was a very famous singing cowboy. they said he died of a heart attack in 1973, but now afterwards they found out that he died of the same cause as John did. Actually, he had an aortic dissection and no one knew about it.
So considering the fact that John was concerned about this while he was alive, and he died the same way at a young age, it makes you kind of wonder, how does Jason Ritter feel?
Well, I guess he's probably, you know, looked after himself. His brother Tommy. John's brother Tommy checked himself, and he almost had the symptoms. So he got that, looked after as soon as possible. So I think the Ritter family are pretty well aware that they may have inherited this condition. So and Amy has been, going around making, people more aware of aortic dissections and getting it checked and getting something done about it.
And we should mention that Jason Ritter is the star of the new NBC series, The Event. How can people get in contact and find out more information about you and Book Banter?
Well, you can read me every week in West End Times online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
No problem, Peter. And I'll say hi to Mr. Roper for you.
Okay, Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program. We have, of course, an idiot of the day coming up, but a few more stories before we get there. Raymond Roberts, age 25, was arrested in Manatee County, Florida in September after an ordinary truck stop turned up a strong smell of marijuana. At deputies' behest, Roberts removed a baggie of marijuana from his buttocks, but when the deputies saw another plastic bag right behind it containing a white substance believed to be cocaine, Roberts said, "The weed is mine, but the white stuff is not." Okay, I may ask friends to hold on to some stuff for me, but I have some strong restrictions as to where they might keep those items. But anyway, there you go. Meanwhile, police in Bradenton, Florida, pulled over a suspicious vehicle. The driver, Paul Ewing, age 35, admitted to officers he was damaging his neighbor's yard because the neighbor owed him $200. He said he had been tossing water balloons filled with herbicides into the neighbor's backyard, and he used a water gun filled with herbicides to squirt on plants in the front yard. Damage to the landscape was estimated to be about $250 at least. Ewing was charged with driving with a suspended license. And why is it they're always caught driving with a suspended license? Somebody's always doing something criminal, and they never get their license in check. You'd think that'd be a simple thing to do. Anyway, he was charged with driving with a suspended license and criminal mischief with property damage. He posted $500 bail. Now, when police asked why the neighbor owed him $200, Ewing confessed, "It was for drugs." So there you go. Live by the chemicals, die by the chemicals. Elsewhere, it started out as a great day for a man from Birmingham, Alabama, who won $19,910 while gambling at a Canadian casino. But it ended up a very bad day after he tried to sneak the money over the U.S.-Canada border and was stopped by border agents at the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel. The problem is he lied about his winnings. He tried splitting the money with a friend to get back into the U.S. to avoid the $10,000 currency reporting requirement. But to verify the amount, the agents ordered them to a secondary exam area where the truth eventually came out. Ronald G. Smith, the chief CBP officer in Detroit, said, "Had he just declared it and filled out the currency report form, he would have gone home with his money. Instead, the guy committed a civil offense, punishable by the seizure of the winnings." Oh, man, that's just a bad day, isn't it? And if he had gone home with all that money, he could have spent some of it at the Stuff File store. Oh, was that a blatant plug for this program and the store that I have? Yeah, I think it is. He could have bought Stuff File t-shirts, caps, mugs, water bottles, even that cute little teddy bear I keep talking about. He could have gone to thestufffile.com and just picked out his favorite item. But he didn't. What can I say? Now, this next story, I was deciding whether to put it into the headline of least competent criminals or on the extreme side, on the other side of simple overconfidence. You decide, because I got two of them and they're kind of similar. Xavier Ross, age 19, passing by a piano at an art exhibit in front of the Grand Rapids, Michigan police station in October, could not resist sitting down to play a few notes and was arrested when officers recognized him from a recent home invasion case. Right across the street from the police station, he decides he wants to play the piano. That's just overconfidence. And also, Jason Williams, age 38, was convicted in Maidenhead, England in October of stealing a neighbor's window curtains, which he had immediately installed in his own windows, in plain view of the neighbor's window. Yeah, that's just overconfidence. Or dumb, but doesn't quite make idiot of the day. That comes later. And this next story comes to the Stuff Filed news desk thanks to Bob Welsh from WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. He was suggesting that this might make an interesting idiot of the day. Well, Bob, it doesn't quite qualify, especially since the guy died, but it does make it to the Darwin file because, as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. The family of a British man who died of a massive overdose from caffeine powder is calling for a ban on the sale of the substance. 23-year-old Michael Lee Bedford, who lived in a town near Nottingham, died in April after ingesting 2 spoonfuls of caffeine powder at a party. That's the equivalent of 70 cans of energy drink. The product, which was obtained over the internet, came with a warning to take no more than 1/16th of a teaspoon. Bedford's family says a friend had bought the caffeine powder and offered it to him. His grandmother told reporters at an inquest last week that she wishes the sale of caffeine powder to be prohibited. At the inquest, coroner Dr. Nigel Chapman warned people about taking caffeine products. He says, "Caffeine is so freely available on the internet for about $5, but it's so lethal if taken in the wrong dose, and here we see the consequence. Consuming large amounts of caffeine, which is more than maybe 600 milligrams each day, could lead to anxiety, difficulty breathing, and an irregular heartbeat, according to the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. Caffeine supplements and energy drinks have come under scrutiny in the U.S. recently as well, as several Central Washington University students were hospitalized after consuming a caffeine-spiked alcoholic drink called Four Loko. Several U.S. colleges, including Central Washington and the University of Rhode Island, have banned the beverage from campus property. So, Bob, while I appreciate you sending the story, and it does indeed make the Darwin file, it's not quite idiot of the day material. But this is...
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff file presents the Idiot of the Day.
Two people are in police custody following an unbelievably lame attempt at a jewelry store heist in El Paso, Texas. Security camera footage shows 44-year-old Naomi Duchesne and 45-year-old Luis Del Castillo arrive outside of Estate and New Jewelry, with Del Castillo pushing Duchesne in her wheelchair. Duchesne then gets out of her chair, covers her head and upper body with a large black plastic trash bag, and enters the jewelry store while Del Castillo waits with the chair. Once inside the store, Duchesne pulls a kitchen knife and demands everything. Store owner Linda Bradley decided not to play along and pulled a gun out as a response. Said Linda, "Then we were chasing each other around the store like Keystone Cops. I knew I could outrun her because she was obviously not very quick." A store customer eventually tackled Duchesne and held her until police arrived. Oblivious to everything going on inside the store, Del Castillo was still waiting outside the store with the wheelchair, so he was arrested too. And here's the dumbest part of all. The couple lives in an apartment right across the street from the jewelry store. Now really, why would someone who obviously needs a wheelchair and lives across the street from a jewelry store decide to rob it with a kitchen knife? One reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0064. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the site, you'll find information and links on all of our guests on the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0064. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me at Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder, and at Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJMedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national carrier China Airlines, and over the air at World FM in New Zealand, Gold FM in Singapore, and WSTJ, St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.